Hold on, it's rolling. Okay, I see a black screen. There we go. Oh my God, finally. Whew. Okay, that took a
Welcome,
moment.
everybody.
Welcome, everybody. Sorry about our 10-minute delay for all everyone who's been patient enough to stick around. I promise it's going to be phenomenal. This is our first live stream, so we're ironing out the kinks. Plus, we're in unusual times. I'm very, very excited to be here today with Seth. How are you, Seth? And
Great. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
this is really a global scenario here. I'm in Israel. Seth is in is from the US, but he's in Brazil actually. Rolin is from South Africa, but he's in Israel. David Lang is in Israel, originally from Australia. We have the Posners, who are the British American. It's basically the whole diaspora is here, so it's great. I want to do a quick round to introduce everyone, because maybe not everyone knows everyone who's here, even though we've had all these amazing people on our talks before. So I'll start with Rolin, South African, born, as I said. You're a passionate advocate for Israel. I'm reading from your bio, so you're on the radio, television. You've been published in the numerous publications. You're a member of the media team in Israel, which is an advocacy body, right, that fights media bias as well as truth be told. And you live in Israel, right? I got it right.
Uh,
Very
and
cool.
then I also, well, I'm a freelance broadcast and print journalist, and also in a voluntary capacity, the head of World Wheat So's public diplomacy and Hasbara.
Okay, thank you. There you go, Seth.
Okay, Leo, there's a note there about the stream. Do you see that? Yeah, there's a
No
note there.
live stream yet, Leo.
What's that? It's
No
not.
stream for some reason, no.
I'm seeing a thing. It says live. It says live on the Jew function. I see it. I'm looking at it.
You see on YouTube.
Make sure you're logged into it. It's for some reason it's not we're
Look,
still
you see?
waiting.
Look at my screen.
Okay, we're live. We're live. They're saying live.
Yeah, we're live. It's live. It's there's
Okay.
a probably a delay until they start, because it's going through the All right, go to this David.
Okay. Also, our friend David Bernstein is with us. Hello, David. David L. Bernstein served as the president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs from 2016 to 2021. He's the author of Woke Anti-Semitism: How Progressive Ideology Harms Jews. Thanks, David.
Great to be with you.
Next, we have the Posners. I'm so excited about these guys. Gerald is an investigative journalist, author of a lot of books, I think 13, New York Times nonfiction bestsellers, Why America Slept, which I think has some relevance here, maybe, God's Bankers, and your latest book, Pharma, right, on the drug industry that often seems to prioritize profits over patients. And his beautiful wife, Trisha. Was also a writer. You're collaborating with Gerald, I know, on many books, but you also wrote yourself. You're the author of The Pharmacist of Auschwitz, The Untold Story. I got it right. Yeah. Nice.
Okay,
Good.
and also we have with us David Lang, Australian-born law graduate. David Lang transitioned from work in the oil and high-tech industries into full-time Israel advocacy after immigrating to Israel. He's a respected commentator and Middle East analyst who's often been cited by the mainstream media. So, friends, we have about an hour here. We hope to accomplish a lot. We hope to, from this connection, to arrive at an understanding of how we got here. It shouldn't be a surprise to any of us. And where is our good future? So let's go.
Yeah, excellent. So we'll start with a short clip. I hope some of you have seen it, maybe all of you. It will be a good backdrop to what we're going to be talking about here. And it kind of shatters me to think about it, because I shot this clip with Andrew in New York about a decade ago. Okay, so you can make whatever you want of it.
Thank you. Check this out. Jews, the Jews. See what happened here? In your gut, something, you reacted, right? The idea, even the word, is something no one is indifferent to. But why? What's the story here?
You think that after 4,000 years of recorded history, we'd have figured out this strange, almost universal hatred of the Jews, but we haven't. You know what? We're gonna have to start to figure it out. We're gonna have to try. The way the world's connected now, everything affects everyone. There's nowhere to hide. And that little problem isn't so little anymore, is it? That innate deadly hostility is exploding around the globe. And if we don't figure it out, it'll trigger a violent self-defense reaction, which is gonna destabilize the entire planet, harming everyone in the process. You know, that whole never again thing. So let's stop pretending and fantasizing. Let's figure it out. Let's take the emotion out of it. Look at things scientifically, empirically. There are facts. The details of any experiment that's been going on for as long as this one has are considered as facts. So let's consider them. So what exactly is the Jewish problem? Is it genocide, their right to self-defense, envy, bigotry, tribalism? No. The problem is that no one, and I mean no one, including the Jews, know what Jews are and what their role is in the world, or that they even have one.
Amazing.
So
what year was that?
It's I find it, we just talked before you guys got on, that it's not a funny thing, but it's part of it is exciting, also terrifying, but we're living in this epic unfolding, and it really is happening, and a lot of people wrote about it, a lot of Jewish sages wrote about it, and I think now seeing those things coming together kind of, it actually gives us also hope. So we want to start by asking everyone here, and you can go in no particular order. Think back to the events of October 7th, which was almost a month ago. It's hard to believe that it's been a month. Mm-hmm. We want to hear, what is your not your feeling about it, but like what's your like explanation for it? Okay, and I know none of you is like you're not a political commentator, you're not military experts. But I want to hear your explanation from your point of view, from the way you're seeing the world, and also, as important, the fallout from all of this, right? What's happening in the world around it, what's happening. Let's just create a common picture for everyone who's listening. So anyone can jump in and start. Let's just keep it short so we have a lot of people. So
anyone can start. You know, you'll all have a view. We started an organization last year called Anti-Semitism Watch, because we thought that the left wing was getting a pass on anti-Semitism, that organizations and prominent Jewish contributors to colleges and other organizations were supporting groups that were for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. At the same time, they were saying that they were pro-Jewish and it didn't fit. And we see the results of that, I think, post-October 7th. We thought and knew, Trisha's tracked anti-Semitism for years on, we knew it was there and bubbling under the surface.
Worldwide.
But the extent of it, and the extent to which it is about Jews immediately, mm-hmm. the sign that goes up in the bookstore in Turkey says no Jews. Doesn't say no Israelis. By the way, if they wanted, it would still be reprehensible, correct. But if they wanted to make it about Israel, but it says no Jews. The signs in so many of the street demonstrations in the campuses go after Jews, who immediately become the target. And you know what you said 10 years ago and walking through the subway is still there. As much as we expected, it still takes our breath away.
Absolutely.
And tells us.
Well, I also have a friend that lost two cousins.
Yeah,
so
everybody's touched in some way personally about it. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the semantics of how it happened or why it happened, I think we'll only start understanding better in the weeks to come. But I think what it has done in a good way and a bad way, because they're both kind of related, is it's blown all the scales have come off. Behind the hiding, behind the accusations of, you know, we're anti-Zionist, not anti-Semitic. Yeah. The masks are off now.
Yeah, that's
I think I think it was Douglas Murray who said it so brilliantly. He said, every now and then you fire a flare and it illuminates everybody around you. And they're well and truly illuminated. So yes. Now they cannot hide behind the accusation. It's about anti-Zionism. It's not about anti-Semitism. And what Hamas did on the 7th of October, apart from murdering, torturing, brutalizing, and kidnapping our brothers and sisters, and we as Wietzo have buried far too many of our kids and community members from this horrific attack, is that it's given a license for people to let their inner Jew-hating freak flag fly freely.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything everyone has said up until now. I mean, just like the atrocious acts, the atrocities of October the 7th were so clear in how vile and evil they were, anyone that tries to explain away or even justify and celebrate it cannot hide, as Rolene said, behind the anti-Zionist veneer. And this anti-Zionist veneer is of the result, as it were, of the Holocaust. We had a bit of a grace period after the Holocaust, I think, as the Jewish people. The world gave us some sort of sympathy yes. points, but I think it's past its use-by date now. So it's kind of also relevant how people are comparing this to the Holocaust in the sense of it's the most Jews that died in one day since the Holocaust. The Holocaust is this sort of theme that comes out of October the 7th. Also in this way, that we've the sympathy points that the Jewish people garnered from the Holocaust have somehow dissipated, and now the inner Jew haters of all these people that were hiding it have come to the fore.
I'd also add to that, I think it's time that we start to talk about the underlying ideologies that are catching on in Western societies that are giving rise to this anti-Semitism. It didn't come from nowhere. You know, when you see 31 student groups at Harvard sign a statement that blaming Israel for the massacre of its own students, it didn't come from nowhere. Now it came from a couple of different sources. I mean, the great Isabella Taborowski, who's a scholar at the Wilson Center, writes about how anti-Zionism really came out of the former Soviet Union. It was a concerted effort by the Soviet Union to invalidate and delegitimize Zionism, especially among Jews in those countries. And that spread and that caught on. Also, I think we have to talk about what many people didn't want to talk about, which is that this radical social justice ideology that neatly divided the world into oppressed and oppressors really caught on. It jumped the lab into the mainstream society. So now young people are equipped with this lens that tells them that the only way you can explain why some people seem to be doing better than others is because some people have oppressed others. And Jews are linked with the oppressor class. And I think that explains a lot of what we're experiencing now in the West. Not everything, because obviously in United States, in UK, in France, and other places, there are large disaffected Muslim populations that are asserting that come with their own homegrown ideologies. But their allies in the West, the progressive radicals who came out with the hand glider memes that celebrated the murder of Israelis, that is something that comes out of our own societies. And I don't think we can effectively fight that anti-Semitism unless we name the causes.
And just going to say one thing to that point about social justice is also seen very much through a prism of race. So Israelis are viewed as white, even though half the country is not white, right? The Jews are viewed as white. People of color are viewed as Palestinians. And so it immediately gets cast in that victimhood way. And you know, we're working on a piece, I hate to tell the decolonizers, but the indigenous people of Israel are Jews, but that's a separate issue. But it becomes, it's this part of that social justice narrative. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, David hit the nail on the head. These are Marxist ideology. And it's all about the power imbalances. And it's a simplistic view where white sort of represents privilege and success. And it's this worldview that if you have a successful party and another party which is less successful or not successful, it's the result. It must be some sort of the result of some sort of injustice, as opposed to capitalism, which teaches that, you know, you reap the fruits of your labor.
So I want to turn our gaze inward a little bit, because everything you describe, those are all great, great details of the picture that surrounds us, sort of the outer conditions that allow this thing to even manifest. And there's probably even more. There's obviously the campaign that is being waged by the Arab world, and there's a lot of other forces at play here. I mean, if you want to open up big geopolitical pictures, right? You have Russia, you have Iran, you have the pipeline from India to Europe competing with the pipeline from Russia to Europe, right? There's like all these other forces at play. There's no question. What we're asking is, and you guys know that we like to do that, is like to look inside for a moment and ask about what you noticed in the conditions that have been sort of percolating underground among Jews in Israel, outside of Israel, in the months and weeks leading up to it.
For example, you know, Josephus is pretty clear when he's talking about what the Romans found when they came into Jerusalem. They found people, Jews, who were at a civil war, killing each other. And it was pretty easy for the Romans. They didn't have to do the dirty work. The Jews were already doing the dirty work. I saw yesterday a video. I'm sure we're all seeing all these kind of videos. But in Tel Aviv, there was a couple tearing down the posters of the kidnapped people. So let's look at like what was the conditions in Israel before this happened. You know,
And you can also talk from your perspective where you live. I know not all of you live in Israel. Three of us live in Israel. Three of us live elsewhere. But really talk about it. And I'll throw one more sort of little thing into this. I really do feel that we, as harsh as it is to say it, that we, in a way, Israel, we were spared a civil war because of this attack. So yeah. So let's dive into this a little bit, and let's hear what you guys have to.
You know, it's funny. I was busy writing an article just before this happened, called "You know what is needed here? What is it going to take to put an end to these divisions?" And I wrote in my article that our history teaches us that every time we are divided, something calamitous happens to reunite us, and I fear something calamitous happening yet again.
Rolene, give a few examples, just to, because it not everybody understands this, and we don't want to just be throwing out slogans. We are very, I mean, our whole thing here on the Jew Function is like in Leo's clip earlier and Andrew's clip, is we're looking at this as like science. We're looking at this as like these are forces of nature. So we're measuring that. So can you give us a few examples? So
You've just given one with Josephus. When the temple was destroyed, we were basically in civil war with each other. And the nearest I can think of is what we have experienced this past year. I think 2023 will go down as the worst year in Israeli history, where we've never been so divided as a country. I mean, families were ripped apart, friendship groups were ripped apart over the issues. And if we look at, you know, maybe conditions leading up to the attacks, and there are a variety of them, we cannot ignore the fact that while we were so busy squabbling amongst each other, our enemies were looking at the prime opportunities to launch an attack. And they did exactly. They were sitting there, you know, puppeteering. And I remember that week very clearly. Al-Khamenei tweeted out, he said, "This is the end of the Zionists," or something like that. And we all, you know, many of us, myself included, said, you know, "Cry more. You know, here's some Zionist tears for you." You know, we poked fun. But I think that we were so focused elsewhere and at each other's throats that we didn't realize we were being told what was going to happen, and the unthinkable happened that Saturday morning, ironically, with communities that couldn't be more peaceful. Mm-hmm. I was there a couple of months ago. I go down to Sderot and surrounds very often. I take delegations for Wheat Zone. and the dairy farmers are the type of people who measured the happiness index of cows. And these were the type of people kidnapped, were the type of people who drove Palestinian patients to hospitals. So I think it has been a big lesson for Israel, and we're certainly seeing it now, that divisions lead to calamity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, it started with the judicial reforms. That's where the division started. And then it spilled over into a religious, not religious divide in some sense. And it seemed so long ago, but it was just on Yom Kippur in Tel Aviv that there was a lot of squabbling over minyan, like an egalitarian minyan. And no one now, I mean, when I say no one, hardly anyone, I would imagine, is even giving that much thought. There would be no question now if Jews of all stripes wanted to pray together and do pray together for the safe return of our captured and for the swift recoveries of our injured, that we would pray together. So it's amazing how quickly things have changed. I think you can look at things, and I'll bring this up because I know our Jew function hosts here like the metaphysical, looking at things in the metaphysical way. On the Rolene explained practically how this could happen. Our enemies seized on an opportunity. There was a perfect storm of circumstances. I believe that part of that was looking at us as weak, as divided, and the Jewish people divided are much weaker. I think also the fact that there's much speculation about this, but the fact that there happened to be this festival, this supernova festival so close to Gaza, they seized on the training that the Iranians provided them. There was some talk that the Iranians didn't know that they were going to attack when they did, and they kind of pulled the trigger a bit early just because they saw an opportunity to do so. But on a metaphysical level, we see this all throughout Jewish history, that anti-Semitism is a way that perhaps God, and I'm a believer in God, uses, it's like a glue to keep the Jewish people together, as horrible as that might sound, for something that seems so destructive. But if it wasn't for anti-Semitism throughout the ages, perhaps we would have assimilated by now. So whenever, this is obviously a very extreme instance of that, of how it can bring us together, but there is perhaps something to
I think, by the way, I had an AC technician. He came a few days after, and I didn't say anything, like, you know, like we were just having a cup of coffee in the middle of what he was working. It was going like, yeah, we're so blind. We can't see what's happening. And, you know, we tore down the barriers between the men, the women, and the Yom Kippur prayer in Dizengoff. And then they tore down the wall between Gaza and Israel. And you had the, you know, a party, you know, we're thinking we're all like full of love, and then they attacked that festival, and the people who were living in those settlements and towns around Gaza are usually the most like peace loving, the ones who were all promoting peace and dialogue. It's almost like showing us, look guys, it's not in those things, it's not in those things, there's something
else. The
answer's
not where you expect it to be. The story is not the story you think it is. There's something else going on, and we have to like break the old mold and understand what I think it's starting to evolve here, but there's some other narrative. You know, like everybody probably knows about the five love languages. You know, if your partner's love language is touch, and all you do is give gifts, it doesn't work. So, you know, you had all these Jews who were like, okay, well, let me bring people to the hospitals. Let me start dialogue. Let me have a festival for peace. But if you're, you know, what's the Leah? What's the Star Wars movie where they had to shoot right in the middle of the?
Yeah, it's the
Empire. Every Star Wars movie.
In everyone, but
everyone.
They tried in the Empire Strikes Back, and then the Return of the Jedi. Yeah,
but you have to. There's a target. There's a special single small place, and you need a lot of firepower. But it doesn't matter if you don't hit the right place. You need a lot of forces. If it's not in the right place, we're not going to get the right answer.
I'm curious, before even we go to maybe the answers, because I want to, you know, delay the gratification a little bit, but I want to hear from our guests who did not live in Israel. Mm-hmm. If you were feeling the same kind of sense of this this split that was happening among the Jews, where you are, or even between Jews in America and Jews in Israel, like this tearing apart at the seams.
Sure. Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think anybody who loves Israel and follows it can was experiencing along with it the sort of excruciating disagreement and dissent and that was happening in society. I was very concerned that the society was tearing itself apart at the seams. I'm a little less inclined toward speculating about larger metaphysical motives. There's a part of my brain, probably like yours, that on one hand is the sort of skeptical Western brain, and on the other hand can run the biblical narrative program and can see this as an unfolding biblical style narrative in Israel. And I can understand the temptation to look at it through that lens. I think we should try to, it's fun to talk about when, you know, over coffee, but I think we should be very careful about speculating. We don't know. We don't know, you know, what the larger plan is. I think it's, if there is such a plan at all. And I think the more humble thing to do is to do our best as Jews and as human beings to support Israel during this time, to know that, you know, there's a lot for us to do. And you know, maybe sometime in the with the hindsight of history, we'll be able to make more sense of it now. Yes,
David, hold on. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we already have 2,000 years of hindsight. How much more hindsight do we need? That's the question. If this was, you know, 10 years after the temple was destroyed, we're like, okay, it happened a couple of times. Who knows? But it happened hundreds of times. Why is it so hard? And I'm not pressing the point. I'm not even talking about, you know, belief in the creator or not, anything like that. I'm talking about we live in a system with laws. You break a law, you feel it. Why can't we start ascribing this behavior and the reaction to it as breaking of a law? That's the question having.
We can define anti-Semitism. We can talk about its manifestations. I mean, that's not a problem at all. I'm talking about sort of a larger theology that tries to explain why there was division in Israel and all of a sudden we're unified around a common war aim. I think that that's where maybe it's where Dave was going with it a bit. We can talk about anti-Semitism, make sense of it. There's been a tremendous amount written. There's a tremendous literature about it. You know, I immediately, because I wrote a book called Woke Anti-Semitism. I mean, a lot of, you know, I'm not the only one. There's been a lot of people writing about how this left-wing ideology is giving rise to a new variant of anti-Semitism that exacerbates the already present anti-Semitism and the anti-Zionism in the world. So I think that there's a lot we can draw on that's already been said and we understand it. I'm not sure that there's that much, maybe to me, it's not that complicated. I mean, I think that there's hatred of Jews. It's been around a long, long time. And there's all kinds of ideologies and conspiracy theories that help exacerbate it. And we're at a moment right now where there's profound insecurity in the world. And people are very inclined to buy into some of these simplistic dogmas that give rise to anti-Semitism.
I do think that's right. But I think also that it's not just external. It's not just anti-Semitism. It is the reaction of Jews, and I'm going to let Tricia talk about this, meaning that in the States, we saw the division in Israel. We watched it, we read about it, we talked to people, we talked to friends, we saw that. But in America, where a lot of American Jews weren't following it in detail, they were putting it into a category that this is sort of like Trump and America. Mm-hmm. It's Netanyahu. If they can get rid of Netanyahu, they'll resolve the problem. The progressive, I'm talking about very progressive Jews. They saw it as a simple thing. And at the same time, they thought that if you asked 10 of them, 9 would say the threat to Jews comes from the right. It's the right-wing extremists, it's the neo-Nazis. They wouldn't even have mentioned Hamas or Palestine as a threat to it. And if you had said Hamas's charter calls for the elimination of the state, they would say that's just a negotiating point. They don't really mean it. And Tricia, you've heard from how many progressive Jews were shocked about what? That their hate. Yeah, so.
It's amazing how many I get this. I could make it like a form letter. Oh, Tricia, we all thought you were over the top or hysterical, but everything you said is true for the last few years. Maybe it's the way I present it. Maybe it's who I am. I mean, coming back to the other discussion about, I think people feel so comfortable now to say the things they would never have said.
Right. I'm sure everyone saw what happened in Washington, D.C.
Being called dirty Jew, head down the toilet, swastikas on, I'm in England, I'm from London. Yeah. That was normal in the 50s and the 60s, and no one stood up for us. No one. Marching down the streets, swastikas on the stone, the gravestones. It was, you know, so for me, I feel like I'm reliving my childhood, you know, with all this hate out there. And I really don't know who's my friend and who's not my friend. You know, am I the Jew girl again or not?
See, all those Rolling
Stones masks
come on.
Yeah, well, I say the curtains are open. Yeah. If you don't know who your enemies are now, you'll never know.
Somebody actually put a meme. It was very, very good. It said, Jews are somewhere between, I'm not that Jew with trembling knees and wondering which of their friends will hide them. But looking at London and Sydney and cities around the world and knowing what we know about Hamas and their charter and what they believe, and watching the woke people completely almost brainwashed. It's like watching a zombie apocalypse of stupid, because they're all marching there, you know, in cartoons when the eyeballs are turning around. It's almost like that, you know, to see signs that say, you know, LGBTQ and superimposed on a Palestinian
flag. They're brainwashed.
And Allah is equality. And I'm thinking to myself, we can't even rationalize with you, because the minute we say...
There's no two sides. They're not taught. They're only taught one side. I mean, we've had, before this happened, how many people called us to say, my son, my daughter's getting, what should I do?
They were having such trouble at schools like Choate and everything else. Bernstein, these prep schools in which one kid said to us, the worst thing I ever did was identify as being Jewish. And, you know, Trish wrote a piece the other day about Jews for Hamas. We joke with that. But, you know, the kids, and they were kids who closed down the Capitol, they rallied for Tlaib, were two Jewish organizations. The young Jewish protesters who were pro-Palestinian, who closed down Grand Central the other day. And it's this remarkable element in which, you think to yourself, you can even be Jewish, and for a moment, you're lost in this self-hatred and apologizing. She says they are Jews in name only. Ginos, she calls them. I don't know if that's true.
So, guys, I'm hearing you, and I'm sure you guys were discussing this amongst yourselves with others. And I hear a lot of these discussions online. You know, what created this? What created the conditions for it and all that? What we're saying is we want to flip the equation on its head. Instead of saying what created it, you know, what was the cause and what was the effect, we want to say maybe the cause and effect were different. Maybe the effect that we're seeing out in the streets from everyone who supports Palestine, people who are, you know, brainwashed, we see that it's something that you cannot actually stand up to individually and try to argue, because
talk about
masses of people who were growing up into this reality. So we have this irrational problem. And so what we're saying is maybe we need an irrational solution. That's where this whole discussion is coming from for us. Because I don't think, you know, I think that nothing we've ever done has worked so far. I'm saying it, you know, to all the politicians, all the movements, all the organizations. I have not seen anything that we do make things better, period. We all are very good at analyzing the conditions and the situation, but we haven't seen anything that actually makes things better. Number one, the West is not helping. Even the Jews in the West are not helping. The media isn't helping. We're not winning the media wars. You two are, you know, Dave and Rolene, your media people.
Impossible.
Are we winning it? We're not winning it. You know, we're fighting it. We're putting up a good fight. We're not winning it.
They deny everything.
Yeah.
So we're not winning. It's like the Holocaust being denied.
Exactly. I'm going somewhere with it. So we're not winning the media wars. We're not changing the narrative. In fact, we're drowning in the opposite narrative. And because, as we said, people are products of their environment, we can't even blame the masses for their weird ideas about Israel, about occupiers, colonizers, apartheid, all that, you know, misinformation about history. It's like, it's almost like an avalanche of ignorance that you can't really stand up to in this way. We can maybe contain it, maybe. And even in the best case scenario, we're kind of stuck in a situation. And not only it's a situation that's happening around us politically and in the media and all that. And to David Bernstein's point, yes, we're stuck in the Bible narrative, whether we like it or not, believe it or not. Yes, that's the one book that influenced all of Western civilization. We're all relating to these ideas and myths that we can say, oh yeah, no, it's there. No, we're living it. You talk to any Muslim person, he's convinced that this is what's happening. So we can sit here and say, no, well, it's this, it's that. What we're saying is none of those things are changing right now. What can we actually do? Maybe all that pressure on the outside is what we call in you know, the Jewish sages call help against. Maybe it's help against. Maybe it's pushing us towards something else. What is it? What is maybe, the reason for that? That's what I'm...
I do think that there are things that have worked. I think a lot won't work and can't work. But, you know, look, 60, 70 years ago in America, Jews couldn't get into a country club, couldn't get into certain law firms, couldn't get into certain medical practices. That's all changed because Jews pushed back. So it's not like nothing has ever worked ever. Things have changed. We're not in the same situation we were 70 years ago. But I also agree that it's very, very hard to win the media wars. And let's understand this. I mean, there are 22 Arab nations in the United Nations. There are 48 Muslim nations. They have dominated the international sphere. They have dominated the extended network of NGOs. They have tremendous collective power to set the narrative. We are 15 million people worldwide, so we don't have the same power going in. And I think so we have to do the best we can. Israel has to win this war. Thank God we have the United States and some European countries with it. You know, and by the way, if Israel is strong in the end, it'll probably bring Saudi Arabia back into the Abraham Accords framework, mm-hmm. and it could change everything.
So you're seeing it as a blip. You're just seeing it as a blip on the general.
No, it's not a blip. It's huge. But and it might unleash positive forces as well. Like, I think in the United States, at least, the behavior of these crazies is absolutely eye-opening. It's the Douglas Murray, the flair. And I think there's tremendous opportunity to expose the nut jobs that are you know, with their hand glider narrative and everything else. I think we can expose those people, but it's not going to be. We're not going to stop the onslaught from all these Arab countries and voices. That's just, they have the numbers.
Well, I mean, in essence, what does it mean? How do you define victory in this? So we can have little wins, and we have little wins all the time. But if you define victory as stamping out anti-Semitism, I can't see how we can do that. It's been around for as long as we've existed, and we'll probably
continue. So a few million versus... Oh, sorry, go ahead, David Lane.
No, go ahead.
A few million versus many billion. It's you know, fighting you know, like that. It's not something you can win if you're thinking conventionally. And you know, this is the challenge that we at the Jew Function have, is that we keep sounding quote unquote metaphysical, or we keep sounding that we're going to something you know, out of the normal. Laws of life. But you know, anywhere you travel in the world, like anywhere you go, there's traffic lights, and pretty much red means stop and green means go, and everyone has more or less doorknobs that work pretty much the same. Like, there's why am I saying that? I'm saying that there's it doesn't matter where you go, like there's an idea, and then it just fills the whole world. Like, why didn't people make roads differently? Why didn't they make traffic lights differently? Why is everything exactly the same wherever you go? So there's, in a sense, there's this structure. There's a certain group of people that make a structure, and the rest of the world lives within that structure. And what we want to point to is that this concept of what is a Jew is that the nations relate to us, the Arabs, the whole world relates to the Jews according to what the Jews are doing, the structure that the Jews are building, who the Jews are towards the world. It's not just that we're 15 million versus a couple billion, and let's have a debate and see if we can get into the country club, you know, or see if we'll be accepted. But is there something much, much bigger? Are we just living our 80 years and then that's it, and we're just trying to just tick off another flag, another flag, another flag? Or is there some much, much bigger picture that we're talking about and we're working towards? Are we just trying to get people to accept us? Because once they accept us and we have our country, we fight against ourselves. So what is our real goal? What are Jews supposed to do? Who are Jews?
What should Jews supposed to do?
What are we? And what are we supposed to be doing?
Can I just say something? There's a wonderful African proverb. How do you fell an elephant? Send a mosquito. A mosquito can fell an elephant. And, you know, we're talking about what we see in the media and what we see in the media, but we're not talking about what we're not seeing in the media. And I like to, and I follow the UK very, very closely. And over the past couple of weeks, I've been following people's comments on articles, on video clips that they're writing. The silent majority is there. David, I think it was you who said these, you know, they're exposing through their behavior exactly all these lunatics who they are. Now, watching the response from people, veterans, ordinary Brits, especially in light of today's vigil to bring the kidnapped back home, the message that I'm seeing from people is, look how they behave, as mm-hmm. opposed to the way they Absolutely. Behave. You know, look Absolutely. At the messaging here as opposed to the messaging there. And there's a lot of it. There's that silent majority that we are not hearing, that we're not hearing from. And, you know, I think it's said in Hebrew that if you want the good work done, you know, a righteous man lets somebody else do the work.
The work of the righteous is done by others.
Yeah, the righteous work is done by others. And I think right now in a funny, like a weird way, the righteous work is being done by others. The more you destroy, the more you scream hate invective, the worse you behave when you climb on the White House and when you deface property and you throw flares and you intimidate people, they're doing their own work for them.
You're absolutely right, because I speak to a lot of friends in that live in London, outside London, and you're spot on. They're just in absolute shock by what's going on. But they have a huge problem because the Met Police are not doing anything. So, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, David, I think David Lang said before, you know, when will we know when this is over, this phase? So we can get back to then debating what is a Jew and figuring out if we're doing more than just our 80 years here on the planet. We'll know when it's over, in the sense of when we start bickering with each other again. I remember after 9/11, unfortunately, we were so united. We lived in New York then, and you couldn't find almost anybody that, you know, didn't think there had to be this response. And we remember how everybody was together, and then over time, how that was lost. And by the time, you know, 2008 came around, Bush lost the election because we were in Iraq and mired in another war. We don't know where it goes, but when the immediate, you know, sort of answer to this comes back, the dismantling of Hamas, then come the tougher questions. And then we do come back to those issues that Seth's talking about, you know, that's sort of the core of this, the theoretical, the metaphysical issues of what is a Jew, what does it mean, and how do we try to stop this in the future? But for now, it seems to me that the reality of what's happened on the ground, the horrors of October 7th are so terrible that my focus has become less, it shouldn't be, but I'll admit, less to the larger issues, less to the metaphysical, more focus on just the response of the country, of the people at this time in history, to being able to stop this, having on a southern border a group that is running a state that says we want to eliminate you, that free Palestine means
freedom. I want to challenge that as well. Again, if this were the first time this happened, then we would say, yes, finally, we can see the truth. But I've been, you know, in Israel, I grew up in Israel. Every time there was another round of intifada, and you would, the guy who, you know, this guy who employed an Arab, then the Arab came back to work and stabbed his employer. Now we know who we're dealing with. 5 years go by, everybody's back to their, you know, because we humans, we like to be lazy and just, you know, not change anything, right? We're back to the same thing. Then another intifada comes around. Then his son comes and stabs him. Now we know. I'm just giving this as an example. When the Holocaust was unfolding in Europe, when did America join the fray? Only after it was like pulled tooth and nail into it and had no choice, right, to intervene. They knew about it before. And might I say, us Jews played a big role in keeping America out of it and keeping Jews out of America. I don't see a different pattern here. I think it's fresh. We're all shocked because it's happened to us. We're not talking about the Holocaust, but I'm asking you guys to really dig deep and ignore actually the world. Don't go metaphysical. Go right here and now between us, but ignore what the world is going to do, because the world is going to do what the world is doing always, taking care of its own interests. Nothing has changed. I'm sorry, gentlemen and ladies, nothing has changed. I don't see any change. America wants a pipeline from India to Europe. America's going to get that pipeline. It's going to put pressure on Israel, blah, blah, blah. America wants to go, you know, go to war with Putin. Putin wants to go to war with America. It's all happening on our backs. I'm saying, what's in our control? What can we actually control?
So what we can control, I do think, and maybe everybody will disagree with this, including Tricia, we can control the response, being the response of the government this time. And you're right. Every time in the past, there's been a war that involves Gaza. And what happens is at one point, the international community comes in and says, so many civilian casualties in Gaza, the pressure comes on Israel. Then we've eliminated enough of the rocket ability that nobody's being shelled anymore. And for a couple of years, there's peace, but that's the end of it. And the very same thing you said is what Hamas was calculating, that they will not go past a certain point, that we can do this. And then if we have the hostages, they traded 1,150 prisoners, including Sinwar, right, for one soldier. They will never come after us like this. And if we stop now, and I say we, meaning the government, if the government stops and they gave in to the pressure and they allowed the Hamas leaders to go to Qatar or to Iran and to have safe passage to revive themselves another day, and they didn't dismantle it, then we hold our head in shame. So this is what we can do for the first time. Guess what? Yeah. The sympathy we had after the Holocaust was because no Jews fought back. They couldn't fight back. They all got killed. And so they couldn't fight back. This time they can fight back. Mm-hmm. And nobody on the street likes that. They like Jews who get killed and can't fight back. Yeah. But when you fight back, then they tell you to stop doing it.
Don't make a fuss.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but I want to hear from everybody. I want to hear from Dave Lang, from Rolene, from David Bernstein. I want to hear how we can, you know, we're sitting here talking about what the government should do and what, you know, everything. I want to know what we can do. I'm going to push on that point. What can we do? I was looking at the media and the role the media, you guys are all media people, you're authors, bloggers, and the role that the media played in sowing those seeds of separation. And again, just even from the most practical perspective, that made us weak, okay? Forget what we can gain by being united beyond, okay? Forget about that. But just the practical value of being united, strong, a united front, we forgot what it means to be united. We need the trouble to unite us. And I'm sorry, we're not united right now. I'm telling you, I'm in Israel. I live here. We're not united. There's people demonstrating, people going against. We depend on each other. We feel the like sheep that the wolves are closing in, so we kind of... we band together. That's mutual dependency. That's not mutual guarantee. That's not this force that's revealed when you really feel something for someone else that is unconditional. I want that. That's what all the sages are talking about. They're all talking about that. I want that. Why don't we want that? Why don't we aspire to that? Why do we aspire to for the world to do something about it?
Don't you guys you're Israel too, and you don't feel that there's this big unity. I really do feel there is this unity. This is this unity in purpose. So everyone, at least, and when I talk about my circles, so I obviously have my religious friends, but I live in a place which is not fully religious, and my circle of friends aren't uniformly religious at all. So I consider the people I associate with from all spectrums of Israeli society. And the common denominator at the moment is people just want to help in any way they can.
A lot.
What I've noticed is that people are utilizing their specific skills. So, for instance, you've got people who, you know, and it doesn't matter what the skill is. You've got people that love to barbecue, for instance. So they're barbecuing. This, you know, every day I drive past a certain street in my town, I see this huge, you know, smoke near a building, and then I look. It's been happening, you know, for weeks. They're grilling for the soldiers, and then you've got people who are good organizers. And they are organizing, you know, clothes and, you know, even vests. And not just people in Israel. We have the entire Jewish world. I've been speaking with people, and they're organizing logistically to bring over special army equipment from the States that we can't get here.
True.
So I really do feel, not just here in Israel, but in the Jewish world, there is unity. Now, of course, there are people within the Jewish world who are working for the enemy. And I think... back to the question, I believe we have to draw more of a line in the sand. And at least from my point of view, I believe we need to excommunicate. And when I say excommunicate, I mean make life uncomfortable for those Jews that have pitched their tent in the enemy camp. So I don't think they should be, for instance, if they go to synagogue, they should be called up to the Torah. You know, when I talk about making life uncomfortable, talking about legal, societal means, I think we've been tolerating these people for too long because we're like, well, it's the Jewish neshama, it's the Jewish heart, we're all part of the same people. But I think these people have taken themselves outside our peoplehood.
I agree with David. I think, you know, once you celebrate the murders of your co-religionists, you know, even if you remove the Jewish element, just the brutality of the way that people were murdered, tortured, brutalized, you don't deserve to be part of our greater society. And I think, you know, this time we fight back. And I don't know who it was who said the world doesn't like strong Jews. You know what? Do you know what we need to do? We need to stop caring what the world likes. Our responsibility is not to get the approval of the world. Our responsibility is to make sure that each other are safe, our country is safe, and that we remain a strong democracy and a haven for the Jewish people. I think that we're so busy worrying about fitting in and the world's approval and what everybody thinks of us. You know what? They don't like us. They don't care about us. And we need to stop being so concerned.
Okay,
yeah,
but this is
going to close the window here for it, because there's a rocket siren.
I mean, my shelter, here we go.
Okay, so we're talking though about having a strong IDF and things like that. But let me ask you, and we'd like, you know, if you haven't spoken, please. We need to cook this here. But you know, if 200 people died. Mm. And 20 were kidnapped, then what? If only 50 died and 5 were kidnapped, then what? Okay, so there's some line that once you cross that line, like, that's too much. But until you cross that line, then, you know, we would have dealt with it differently. So the main point here is, are we able to do this? Are we able to barbecue for each other? Are we able to take care of each other? Is each one able to do their thing without someone coming to kill us? Are we able to do that without people coming to kill? And not only coming to kill us, because if they only kill 20...
We've got a big barrage coming, sorry.
What's that, Rulin?
We have a very big barrage of rockets coming.
Yeah, I know. I just, my family's here in the room as well. If everybody's watching it, they're here.
Be safe, guys. Be safe.
Well,
yeah. I mean, it's a good question, Seth. And, you know, we've been, Jean-Paul Sartre argued that the anti-Semite makes the Jew. And you know, there's always been evidence of that. I hate to say it, like Jews, we see it now in Israel. We're more united than ever because of the ghastly acts committed by Hamas. Does that mean that's all who we are? No, of course not. It's not all who we are. We have to do more to define ourselves. You know, maybe the one thing that we can do that's most important in fighting anti-Semitism is just Jewish pride and Jewish consciousness. And really developing that in our people, like strategies. Sure, I mean, I have an organization that is developing strategies to oppose anti-Semitism on the left, and we're trying all kinds of things. And some of those things may work, and some of those things may not work. The one thing I think that makes us more resilient people to whatever comes our way is a strong sense of Jewish pride. And if we can attain it, some semblance of Jewish unity, you know, there might, you know, we're not going to, you know, this is going to be fleeting. You know, people aren't going to be doing the barbecuing for soldiers forever. And so let's take that spirit as much as we can and turn it into some permanent gains and know that there's going to be more division because we're always going to be somewhat divided.
Well, hold on. Division is fine. We're okay with that. We excel at that.
The whole Talmud is fighting, you know, one guy, yeah, Hillel versus Shammai.
Debating.
But it's okay. We can butt heads, but not wanting to cancel each other out. And that's what I've been seeing, and I'm still seeing it here on the sidelines. People are sharpening their knives, waiting for the thing to over to so one group can get over. This is killing us, guys. It's killing us. Rav Kook wrote the revealed unity of the moral, spiritual, and intellectual world with the material, practical, technical, and social world is expressed in the whole world by Israel. And the virtue of the land of Israel is to establish in the world the manifestation of this unity that gives a new face to all human culture. He's just one guy of hundreds of sages that have been writing it every year, every generation. They write to us these things. We say, oh yeah, of course. When it's tough, we'll stick together. We'll barbecue for each other. And then it's each one to his own. Why stop there? Maybe the solution is in that one thing that we all kind of are so, easy to brush off. It's like, it's a nice idea to have. It's metaphysical. We say all those nice things. Why can't we just embrace it, guys?
But here's the part. So we have the survivor DNA that runs through, right? Fine. Especially when the threat is external. But isn't it interesting when you described, those of you in Israel, the extent to which the country was more divided than you had ever seen before October 7th. And that it's that division and that idea of a civil war in Israel, it would be only Israel could fall from within. It's almost as if only Jews could take it apart by being so torn asunder on different issues. You know, you asked before, Seth, what's the number that, you know, makes this different than something else? And you're right, it's an interesting way of putting it, because there's some point at which it's not just the number, but it's the horror of what was happened. What if Hamas had crossed over on October the 7th and just went after military posts and police stations and shot just people in uniform and killed 200 as they did, but still a horrible thing. But every civilian they went past, they let go past. We'd still be horrified, but not the same as chopping off babies' heads and burning women and raping. So I'm saying there's a degree to which this went over. But the external threat aside, when it's great to have dissension, but you can't have it to the extent where you say, like, people are out with the knives, they're ready to undermine. They want the opposition of what they oppose so strongly that they're actually bringing down the people. That's the threat.
So,
sorry, I just want to jump in here. Listening to the other answers. So, yeah, I've always espoused Jewish unity, and I've always believed that, and I'm familiar with Rav Kook's work. But we have an added advantage, meaning, just if you don't believe in the deeper levels in terms of the solutions, just in terms of where we are in the world, I think most people in the West don't understand that the normal rules of the game don't apply. So mm-hmm. Here in the Middle East, we understand that strength is deterrence, is power, and it means we're stronger. Mm-hmm. So we have this added benefit by, you know, portraying a unified front and being together in that way. We will keep the enemy at bay. So whether or not you believe in what Rav Kook is saying, I think if you just look at the way the world runs, and especially the Middle East, we could see benefits to you know, acting in this way and showing our strength.
You know, there's always this moment where I think Seth in the beginning said it. It's like, you know, we can't convince people of this. It's something that has to be felt. You know, it's something that has to be felt. Like, you know, we can sit and ask, well, was the reason that we were at each other's necks why they, that was the reason that we slept, as Gerald, as you wrote in your book, that, you know, CIA, FBI were at each other's necks, they missed all the signs, right? Was that just a technical reason? Or was that the reason that they actually came for us? And again, asking this at every turn of every Jewish calamity and every Jewish pogrom and every Jewish expulsion, kind of, again, for us, it's crystal clear. Seth and I, for us, it's clear. But I realize it's a hard pill to swallow. We're all rational people. We all live in this world. We all want answers. You know, if I get a bigger army, I get a this, if I do that, da, da, da. But it's almost like from above something, and again, I don't sound too metaphysical for David, but it's not like, you know, it's almost like, how can it be, you know, the most advanced army in the world, all the technology, everything, someone like put a blindfold in our eyes that morning, you know? And again, it's one example out of hundreds. I want us to do, because we're coming into a close here, I want us to really to try something, because we had a bunch of other questions, but you guys were like going on in so many great areas. But I realize it's a tough thing to have, but I also realize that we're not the political podcast, we're not the military podcast, we're not the one where people are going to debate the, you know, how many soldiers and all that, and the it's not going to happen here. But if we could start some sort of a Jewish manifest, right? You know, there was like the Declaration of Human Rights, right? There was the Declaration of Independence and all that, which you know, was a nice document. But if we could start fresh, you know, after everything we've gone through, you know, and just think of ourselves, forget it, but close out the world. The world does not exist. It's just us here. And we start this manifest, and each one here will add one line to this manifest of our, that speaks of our role or our relationship towards one another, something that we want to sort of believe in, that we want to fight for, that no matter what happens, no matter what comes our way, we stick to that, that will be our, you know, that will be the new protocols of the Elders of Zion, the correct protocols, not the ones that was accusing us of all these conspiracies, but the one that the world would hold and say, oh my God, that's what it's about. That's what Jews are here for. Not another startup or not a technology, because we already proved that we gave it all, wasn't enough. But maybe that thing that we can do between us, that sense of unity. So let's do a round on that. Maybe each one will just add something to that document, and maybe we'll publish it one day.
I think that's the thing about Jews, is that no matter what we go through, we are the eternal optimists. Mm-hmm. We are stubbornly full of hope. It's and maybe that's the secret to our survival. It's coded in our DNA that we will survive no matter what, and we cling to that hope and that ideal of peace like a limpet. We are stubborn like that, and maybe that's why people are triggered by us, because we hold that mirror up that, you know, no matter what you throw at us, you can burn us, you can gas us, you can aspire to annihilate us, you're not going to get rid of that stubborn quest and hope for peace. That's who we are.
So what's your line? Just give us the line to the manifest. What's your line to the manifest? What do you commit to as a Jew to other Jews, not to the world, just between us?
I think, and I can only speak to what I'm feeling right in this moment. I've lost my will to really give a damn about what others think of us. My inclination right now is to hold my fellow Jew, my fellow Israeli, a little tighter and a little bit more with love. That's my priority and my focus right now. The rest is all noise, and they will do what they will do.
Right.
My priority as me is to hug my fellow Jew, my fellow Israeli, harder, tighter, and with more love.
Mine's short and sweet. Short and sweet. Be proud to be Jewish. That's it.
That's right.
Yeah, Trisha. And I would just say, I guess,
and to he's the manifesto. Only
half Jewish. Yeah, I guess the manifesto, I would add the idea that we have no safe room if we don't have a Jewish state. We have no safe room without Israel.
That's a minimum.
I've got two thoughts. I want to borrow from Rabbi Hillel. Treat your neighbor as you want to be treated. The rest is commentary. And then I want to borrow from a meme that I saw, which is, let's just skip to the eating part.
Yes. I've got, okay, so here's what I have. I'm going to make one metaphysical comment and then give you my one line. It's that the moment that Jews are allowed to be Jews and are not subject to this kind of anti-Semitism, maybe that's the moment where the world is good enough where the role of the Jew and the mission of the Jewish people is not required anymore. That would be, and so it's sort of, our plight is sort of built in for us. At this moment, I would say that my one-liner would be, our role is to give Israel all the room it needs in the West and everywhere else to be able to finish the job and do what it needs to do.
Seth?
That on the outside, we're iron, and on the inside, we treat all of Israel like a family, all the Jews like a family, and that our goal will be to expand that family until it includes all of humanity.
Nice. I will also read another quote, since David also brought the quote here. I'll bring another one from Baal HaSulam, Yehuda Ashlag. He writes in a letter that he wrote to his students when he was actually in London. Says, I feel you all together that today has changed for you to tomorrow. And instead of now, you will say later. And there is no cure for it, apart from trying to understand this error and distortion, that the one who is saved by the Creator is not saved apart from the need for his salvation today. And he who can wait for tomorrow, his mind will achieve wisdom after his years. And it became a party of negligence for you in my request to make an effort to love friends, which I explained to you in all 70 languages, that this virtue is enough to make up for all of your deficiencies. So what can I say? This is the part where we have to start parting ways. This has been wonderful. It's been great. Your passion, your desire to share, to cry out to the world. This was wonderful. And I really thank you for your time and for your efforts and everything that you do, each one in your own sphere. And I know you're all gonna take this quality to whatever you're gonna do next. Next blog post, your next whatever. But I just hope that you never leave this little connection that we have here and each other.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Be safe, in Israel.
This is the Jew Function, and we'll see you all next time. Like, share, comment, share this conversation. There will be more, I promise. Maybe even next week. So stay with us, and we'll see you all next time and end of our stream.